So today is December 15th, 2013 in Dallas, Texas, and we're going to be summarizing chapters 1 through 6 of the Bhagavad Gita. So if you haven't read the Bhagavad Gita, please don't just take the summary. Please go to the book and read it.
Thank you, Mata.
Hare Krishna.
It's just an amazing book. My first contact with the Bhagavad Gita was when I was in college. I was a freshman in college, and I went with my good friend to her. We went to go say hello to her boyfriend, and her boyfriend's roommate had this Bhagavad Gita in his room, just lying around the room. And I said, "Oh, is that the Hare Krishna book?" And he said, "Yeah, would you like to borrow it?" I'm like, "Sure." He said, "I just looked at the pictures, never read it." And so I took the book back to my room, and I didn't go to class, I didn't go to meals, I didn't sleep much. I was just reading and reading and reading, and I thought, I've never read anything like this in my life. It was amazing. I felt like anything I've ever guessed at or wanted or was right there in front of me. And I thought the only person who could have spoken this book had to be God. No ordinary person could have spoken this book. And it really, really transformed my life. I said, this is what I'd come to a temple years before that. But I thought, this is what I have to do. And it's interesting also, I don't even know how many times I've read the Bhagavad Gita. I don't know, 30, 40, I don't know. I stopped counting a long time ago. But it was funny because in preparation for this class, which I've also given many times, a summary, I was going through and reading the verses again in the first six chapters and listening to a recording of someone else reading the verses. And again, I thought, this is the most amazing book. It just doesn't matter how many times I've read it. And the main thing I was thinking when I was listening and reading was, I want this. So that's really the purpose of Bhagavad Gita. The purpose of Bhagavad Gita is for us to say, I want this. I want to be an enlightened being. Because the whole world works on desire. Now that's explained a little later on in the Bhagavad Gita that we'll be covering today. But everything in the world works on desire. We say that nitya nitya nam tetanas tetananam eko bhavanam yogavadavati kaman. Among all the eternal living beings, there's one living being who's fulfilling everyone else's desire. And we understand that whatever's happening to us is the result of our own desires. And you can say, well, I don't really want everything that I've got. Well, the problem is we don't know what to desire. And we don't understand the real results of our desires. Just like in that story, we all know the story of Midas. He wanted everything he touched to turn to gold. He didn't know what to desire, and he didn't understand the results of that desire. He didn't understand the results of that desire would mean that he couldn't eat, that he couldn't hug his child. He didn't understand that would be the result. And when his food and his child turned to gold, he could have said, well, that wasn't what I wanted, but that was exactly what he wanted. So whatever we have, whatever we are experiencing, is exactly what we have wanted in this life and in previous lives. But we are so foolish, we don't know what to want. And we don't understand the results of what we want. So the purpose of the Shastra, the scripture, the sacred literature, like the Bhagavad Gita, is to increase and increase and increase that desire. Especially Krishna says this in the 12th chapter, Icha. The purpose is to increase our desire. So we say, I want spiritual realization. I want enlightenment. I want love of God. I no longer want to be some big important person in this world or to get things in this world or have everybody love me in this world and all these things that we're all aspiring for. So I hope as we go through this summary that if you already have a desire for enlightenment and you already have a desire for spiritual life, I hope it will increase. And if you don't, I hope it will be kindled. So Bhagavad Gita starts, perhaps, strangely enough, for a spiritual treatise on enlightenment, not in a Himalayan ashram, not by a beautiful lake with birds singing and flowers blooming. It starts in the middle of a battlefield Now, in those days, war was only between members of the military, not like today, where everybody is fair game. You just throw the bombs anywhere. So it wasn't like that. It was only between trained soldiers who had volunteered to fight, and they went away from the general populace to a battlefield. Now, the place they picked for a battlefield, Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra, they picked a place, Kshetra means place, they picked a holy place, Kurukshetra. It's also Dharmakshetra. It's a place of dharma. Dharma means the real nature of a thing, the real essence of a thing. And you can translate dharma as religion or spirituality. It really means what's the thing's essence. What is the truth of a thing? So what is our dharma? So the place of dharma, the place where you find truth, the place where you find spirituality. So it was a holy place for a very long time. Holy place means tirtha. Holy place is also called tirtha. Tirtha means a ford, not a car. Like there's this school in the UK called Oxford. That means the place where the oxen used to cross the river, to ford the river. So a place where you go over the river, like a bridge. So a tirtha means a place where you go, and it's like a connection. You know how there's a lot of science fiction about how there's portals to other worlds? That's not science fiction. There really are portals to other worlds. Some of them are permanent, like Vrindavan and Mayapur. Some of them are temporary, like this place. This is a temporary tirtha. It's a temporary portal. It's not going to exist eternally as a portal, but for the time being, it does so. And it is possible, if you know the secret, when you come here, to enter into another world. So anyway, Kurukshetra was a holy place, is still a holy place like that, and they had this battle at a holy place. Now you would say, well, what are they doing having a battle at a holy place? Because in those days they understood that things were ultimately decided by dharma. They had rules for battle, and the idea was if you followed all the rules, that whoever was most in dharma, whoever was most in harmony with truth, would win. So Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra, and the very sad thing about this battle was that, like in the American Civil War, there were relatives on both sides. There were relatives and friends on both sides. There were cousins fighting cousins, and there were students fighting teachers, and it was really quite a sad situation. But the war occurred because there was an evil person, Duryodhan, who had illegally usurped the government and was harming the citizens. And therefore, the rightful rulers wanted to take back control of the government, not for their own sake, but for the good of the citizens. And the rightful rulers were five brothers, the sons of Pandu, therefore called the Pandavas. So those of you who aren't familiar with this, I'm really sorry for giving you a whole lot of names and words that you're not going to remember. And when I first read the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 1 completely bewildered me. I didn't understand it. It's like, what is this about? Every other word is a new Sanskrit word that I've never heard before. So I kind of went through it quickly and got into chapter 2. So I'm sorry, the history is going to be a little much if you're not really familiar. It took me a couple years of being in the Hare Krishna movement before I really got all the names and the histories and like that. But anyway, there's this evil, just get the idea, there's this evil king. If you don't remember his name, is Duryodhan, that's fine. And against him are the five Pandava brothers. And particularly we're looking at one of these princes named Arjuna. So Arjuna was fighting for his elder brother to again become the king. So everybody's on the battlefield, there have been peace negotiations that have been tried, actually for many, many years at this point. And the extent to which Duryodhan was willing to go was revealed. He tried to murder all of the Pandavas. He insulted Yudhisthira's wife in a public assembly by trying to take off all of her clothing. So many things. It was revealed in so many ways the lengths to which Duryodhan would go to maintain his evil empire. And there was just simply no alternative now but war. So Arjuna is there on his chariot with his horses, ready to fight the battle. And although they had chariots and horses, we shouldn't think that this was a primitive battle. These persons also had divine weapons. They had weapons like atomic bombs, but that wouldn't create general radiation that would kill other people. It could be just aimed at one particular target. They had weapons not only of fire, most of our weapons today are fire, they had weapons of water, they had weapons of wind, they had weapons of earth. They had very sophisticated weapons. So even though they were using bows and arrows, they could mount upon their arrows with mystic mantras, many different weapons. So anyway, Arjuna's there, and Arjuna's not an ordinary prince fighting an ordinary battle for righteousness and good government, but Arjuna is a saint. He's a completely enlightened, self-realized soul, and driving his chariot is God himself. So God himself is coming as the servant of his devotee. And Krishna is there. Krishna said, I personally will not fight in this battle, but I will drive the chariot of Arjuna. So the battle's about to begin. And again, they had rules. How it was, so they were lined up on both sides. And in chapter 1, we hear about how the persons on each side were blowing on a conch shell to announce the start of the battle. And when Arjuna and Krishna on their side blew their conch shells, Duryodhana and his party had their hearts shattered as indication of the outcome of the battle. And then Arjuna says to Krishna, instead of, okay, let's go fight, he says, my dear Krishna, Senayor Ubayor Madhyayi, please take me into the middle of the armies, between the two armies. I want to see who's here. I want to see who's going to fight. You just want to see who's here? Okay. So even though Krishna's God, our idea of God is not just some big old man in the clouds telling people to go to heaven or hell. Our idea of God is a very personal one, who has a very personal, loving relationship with his devotees. So he said, okay, if that's what you want to do, that's what we'll do. And then Arjuna looked at everyone in the battle, and he was overwhelmed with grief. He says, I don't want to fight. I've come here to fight, but I don't want to fight. How can I enjoy, this is one of his arguments, says, how can I enjoy winning the kingdom if all the people for whom I want to enjoy the kingdom with, if they're all going to die? What kind of enjoyment will that be? How will I get any pleasure out of running the kingdom when my friends and families will all die? Then another argument of compassion. I don't want to cause any harm to any of these people. I love them. I care about them. They're my family. They're my friends. Why should I cause harm to anybody? His next argument was sin. He said some of the people on the opposite side said, there's my teacher, Drona. There's my grandfather, Bhishma, on the other side. He said, I'll be overcome with sin if I fight against my superiors who took care of me. He said, even if they want to kill me, they can kill me, but I'm not going to kill them. He said, I'll stand here without weapons and let them kill me, but I will not fight in a battle against them. And then his fourth argument was, I'm going to destroy society. So in those days there were no women in combat roles, although sometimes the women drove chariots, occasionally, but generally not. And sometimes, there's some stories of certain women going into the battlefield, but generally not. So he said, if I kill all these men, then the wives, the mothers, the daughters, they're all going to be without anyone to take care of them. He said, in society we become degraded, there'll be illegitimate children born. Sociologists tell us as soon as we get to, I think it's like 17% of the society having illegitimate children outside of wedlock, that society starts to crumble. Right now in America, we have 40% of children born out of marriage. 40%. When I was 10 years old, there were only 4%. Those statistics certainly indicate, according to sociological statistics, the falling apart of society. So Arjuna said, the society is going to fall apart. The culture will be destroyed. Then he said, my dear Krishna, I don't know what to do. I don't want to fight. I don't want not to fight. Whatever I do is going to be terrible. If I don't fight, these guys are going to rule everything, and they're evil. And if I fight, everything's going to be destroyed. What am I going to do? So most of us are not in the middle of a war, but most of us have questions in our lives. What do I do? Do I do this? Do I do this? What's going to bring me the greatest happiness? How am I going to find success in my life? How am I going to do what's right for me and what's right for others? And I'm sure we ask ourselves this at least once in a day, if not several times in a day. What's the right thing to do? What's the thing to do that will bring me the greatest happiness? Even if it's over something, you know, small, like do I take an extra helping of mashed potatoes or not? I mean, we're always asking ourselves this question, what will bring me the greatest happiness? And we don't know, because we can't see the results of our actions, can we? We don't know. If I do this, what will it cause? So Arjuna said, "Now I'm bewildered. I don't know what my duty is." And he said, "Krishna, I accept you no longer as my friend, but I accept you as my guru." Of course, God is the ultimate guru. And then quite humorously, perhaps, right after accepting Krishna as his guru, he said, "I'm not going to fight." So first he says, "You ever had people ask you for advice like this? Please give me advice, but this is what I'm going to do." You ever had people ask you for advice like this? Yes, sir. Maybe we've done that to somebody. So Arjuna did that. He said, "Krishna, I accept you as my guru." And then he puts down his weapons. He's overwhelmed. He was very emotional. He wasn't just speaking intellectually. He was very emotional. He was overwhelmed with seeing future calamity. And he just said, "I shall not fight." And then Krishna's like, "Okay, you accepted me as a guru. I'm going to take the position of guru. My dear friend who's now a disciple, you're a fool." Said, "You've made many good arguments, but you're lamenting for something you shouldn't be lamenting for. You're confused. You're seeing illusion instead of truth." Says, "Yes, we should be compassionate, but you're compassionate on the wrong level." Said, "Everyone is going to die. When people die, they simply go to another body. Just like in this life, I had a little baby body. So if we took all the adults in this room and we took their baby pictures and we put them up on the wall and asked you to match, could you do it? Not very well. Because we're in a different body. It's not just that that body just got blown up like a balloon and got bigger. You know, it's quite different." Even it was so embarrassing. A few years ago, I showed someone a picture of when I was 25. With my husband and our two oldest children who were little at the time, and someone said, "Oh, where are you in that picture?" Yeah, really. It was like, oops, I'm in a different body. So we're really reincarnating even in this body. We have a different mentality also. I hope that all of us over 15 think differently than we did when we were 2. And if we're over 30, I bet you think differently than you did when you were 15. So our mind has changed, our body has changed, but yet we have this, a sense of continuing identity. I know I'm the same person who, when I was 4 years old, said to my mother, "I want to find the truth." I know I'm the same person. I remember asking her that, telling her that. But I have a completely different body, and I even have a completely different mentality. So Krishna says, when this body dies, you go into another body. Just like in this life, you've gone through so many bodies. Na jayate miyate vakadachit nayam bhutva bhavita bhavna bhuya ajona chasasvatoyam prano nahanyate hanyamane shirire. Said, you are not this body, and these people, all these kings and princes and warriors, they're not their bodies either. They're souls, the soul. From the soul, there's never birth or death at any time. He's not come into being, will not come into being, does not come into being. The soul is eternal, ever existing and primeval. The soul does not die when the body dies. Said, the real person you should be compassionate for is the soul. Not just on the bodily platform. And he said, real enjoyment doesn't come from winning a kingdom or not winning a kingdom or fighting or not. Real enjoyment comes from doing things that are dharma. Real enjoyment comes from doing things that are truth for the purpose of enlightenment. Rather, I don't mind children, by the way. I mean, if they scream, they should be taken out. But if they're just making little children noises, I don't mind. So real enjoyment comes from doing what's in harmony with truth for the purpose of enlightenment. That's what enjoyment comes from. Enjoyment doesn't come from winning kingdoms or not winning kingdoms or this or that or the other thing. It comes from acting in harmony with the truth for the purpose of enlightenment. And he said, you can't determine sin just by, are you killing your teacher? He said, that's not the whole way you understand what is sinful. He said, you understand what is sinful and not sinful by whether or not you're acting in harmony with truth. So a very simple example, like here I have a cup of water. So what's truth is that if I drink the water, that's good for me. What's not true is if I try to eat the metal, it's not good for me. And there's somebody in the Guinness Book of World Records who ate an airplane little by little. This body is not in harmony with eating metal. This body is in harmony with drinking water. Or another example is this room. There's a door and there's walls. If you try to walk through the walls, you'll feel pain. That's not because the builder or the architect don't like you. So if we act in harmony with truth, we'll be happy, and if we act out of harmony with truth, we will suffer. And that's how we understand what is sin. Sin means acting out of harmony with truth, doing something that's false. So it might be in some circumstance that fighting, even with people who are your teacher and your grandfather, that might be in harmony with truth. That's how you have to determine, Krishna said, what's in harmony with truth. Not just by ordinary morality. Then Krishna said, you should engage in yoga. You should engage in Buddha yoga, the yoga of intelligence. Unite your intelligence, Krishna said, with me, with the Supreme Lord. Become absorbed in internal spiritual pleasure and offer your activities to the Supreme as a sacrifice. Yajnartar kamano nacha lokoyam karma bandana taratam karma kantayam mukta sangha samantra. He said, if you really want to be free from suffering, then become in harmony, linking. Yoga means to link. Link in harmony with the Supreme. Offer everything to the Supreme as a sacrifice and work with detachment. And Krishna said, your activities might look ordinary then. It might look like you're fighting a battle and someone else is fighting a battle. But you'll be in transcendental ecstatic pleasure, untouched by anything of the world. And another person who's working for their false ego and to get something in the world, they'll be enmeshed in the cycle of karma. I mean, Jesus said something similar. He said two people are working side by side, one stays and one is taken. And some people interpret that there's going to be some rapture someday and half the people are going to float in the sky. But Krishna says something very similar. He doesn't talk about people floating in the sky. He says that what's night for materialists is day for the enlightened, and what's night for the enlightened is day for the materialists. Now that's literally true, that very materialistic people go to bed at 3 in the morning, and people who want to be enlightened wake up at 3 in the morning. But Krishna was also talking about the fact that if you do your duties in transcendental consciousness, in linking with the Supreme, and offering them as a sacrifice, then those duties are done on a different level. They have nothing to do with the world. And that's what makes something ultimately a source of happiness or a source of pain. Krishna says if you act like that, you bring happiness to yourself and you also help all of society. He said, Arjuna, you're worrying about destroying society. He said, but society gets destroyed when people neglect their duty, when people think selfishly about oh, this is what I want at the present moment. I mean, isn't that where unwanted children come from? Isn't that where illegitimate children come from? People don't want to do duty and don't want to do any sacrifice? Let me produce some kid and walk away? So he said, Arjuna, if you walk away from this battle, which is your duty, because you're one of the leaders in society, everyone else will walk away from their duty, and that's what's going to create illegitimate, unwanted children. He said, when you stick to your duty, even when it's difficult, that is what builds society. And Krishna said, look, I'm God. I don't have to do anything. And still, I incarnate on the earth, and I set an example. just so everybody will know, I have to do the right thing for the right reason. And Krishna says, you know, generally, if people give up their duties, it's not because they're renounced and detached. It's because of their own lust. Because Arjuna says, well, why do we seem to do bad things even against our will as if forced? And Krishna says, it's just your own lust. It's just your own selfishness. You're not a victim. There's no devil making you do it. It's your own desire to enjoy the world rather than a desire for enlightenment and love of God. So then Krishna is explaining, okay, if you're going to work as a sacrifice for the Supreme, if you're going to work in detachment to please the Supreme rather than to please your own senses, you're going to have to know something about the Supreme. So Krishna starts talking about himself. He says, Evam para para prata, evam rajasa yoga dutaka. What is that? It's third line. Sakana. Yoga nasta parantapa. Okay, thank you. So Krishna says, I've been explaining this supreme secret through the chain of the disciplic succession. He said, I explained this supreme secret millions of years ago to the celestial being who rules the sun. And it's been passed down from student to disciple to student to disciple. And today I'm explaining it again to you because yidahidahi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata bhutinama dharmasya tadatmanam sujamyaham. I come over and over and over again whenever people forget dharma, whenever people forget truth, to reestablish what is the real truth. Parichranaya sadhanam vinashaya tadushkutam dharmastam stapanataya sambhavani yuge yuge. When there's evil people in the world, I come to destroy the evil and to reinstate piety. And anyone who understands this about me, janma karma chame divyam evam yo veti tatvata tvartvate ham punar janma naiti nami sorjuna. Anyone who understands the nature, Krishna says, of myself, the Supreme, they're not entangled in karma. They're not entangled in reincarnation. They're not entangled in selfishness. They rise above the world. And they do this through various kinds of sacrifice. And Krishna details all different kinds of sacrifice. He talks about sacrificing the objects of the senses and the fire of the senses, which basically means you use the senses for transcendence instead of for sense gratification. Sacrificing the hearing process by hearing about transcendental things. And he talked about kinds of yoga where you sacrifice the breathing process and have the ingoing and outgoing breath sacrificed into each other and enter into a state of trance. He says, if you want to know how to work in sacrifice, you have to approach a spiritual master. Tadvati pranipatena parivarshanam sevyam upadekshantite gyanam gyaninas tadvadarshina. So if you want to know how you can personally live a life of connection with the Supreme in acts of giving, you have to go to a teacher. Because there's all these different ways of doing it, and you're going to have to learn what is the way that you should do it. Of course, Krishna was there as Arjuna's guru, but he's giving this instruction for all of us, that we can't just say, well, I think I'm going to connect with the Supreme like this, and I think I'm going to be in transcendental consciousness like this. We have to have tattva darshina. Tattva means truth, darshina means to see. We have to come to someone who's already seen the truth, and they can help us to understand also how to see the truth. And Krishna explains that there's action in piety, there's good action materially, bad action materially, and then there's inaction. There's transcendental action. Both good action and bad action bind us to this world. Good action will get us a more beautiful body, a richer body, etc., etc., in our next life. Bad action will do the opposite. But inaction, transcendent action, action that's not action, action that's in transcendental consciousness takes us out of the world. And then Arjuna said, well, I'm really confused because, okay, you're telling me that I'm supposed to fight this war in transcendental consciousness with linking with the Supreme. I'm not supposed to fight it for selfish reasons. And at the same time, you're talking about this yoga of intelligence and just engaging in spiritual sacrifice and cultivating knowledge and not doing anything abominable. And these things seem opposite to me because this war seems pretty abominable. And I think if I really want to attain enlightenment, I should just leave the battle and, you know. And many people think this way. If I really want to attain enlightenment, I should leave my family, leave my job, you know, just leave America, go to the Himalayas, or maybe go to Canada. Well, when I was 16, I went on a bike ride in Canada. We were riding through Jasper Banff National Park, and then we came to Lake Louise. It was a beautiful place. So people think you have to go to a place like that, you know, pristine, not do anything in the world. And so Arjuna was thinking, well, if I'm going to do the yoga of intelligence and link with the Supreme, how can I do it while I'm shooting arrows? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And then on the other hand, Krishna, you keep telling me, fight in transcendental consciousness. I don't get it. So Krishna says, well, you know what? It's a lot better to do active work in transcendental consciousness than just to renounce. He says, it's true that if you just renounce everything and cultivate knowledge, you'll get the same result as working in transcendental consciousness. But generally speaking, we have to be active just to live. So everyone has to do some work just to maintain their body. How are you going to give up work? How are you just going to do nothing? He said, since you're going to work anyway, better to work in transcendental consciousness. However, Krishna says, if one's already liberated, if one's already enlightened, then it's true, such a person doesn't need to work. He says, such a person doesn't need to work, and such a person doesn't need to stop working. Such a person doesn't need to depend on any living being, because such a person sees me everywhere. They see me everywhere, and they see everything in me. Such a person sees an elephant and a dog and a low-class person and a high-class person. And they see them all as souls. And they see God everywhere. They don't have any needs to fulfill. So such a person can go just sit and meditate. They have nothing to accomplish. But until you're at that point, better to work in the world in transcendental consciousness. And even if you're at that point, you may still work in the world just to set an example to help others come to that point. Because if people see you as an enlightened being giving up everything, they may think that's the path to enlightenment instead of the result of enlightenment. So there are many beings who attained enlightenment, but who continue to work in the world in enlightened consciousness to set an example. He said, Krishna says, if you really want to achieve peace and you really want to achieve happiness, then Voktiram Yagatapasam Sarvalok Maheshram Suvidam Sarvabhutanam Gyatramam Shanti Richiti. Then please know, Krishna says, that I am the one meant to enjoy all the activities. Just like the stomach is meant to enjoy all the food. You don't stick food in your eyeballs, right? If you want to have healthy eyes, you put food in the mouth. Isn't that funny? If you want to have healthy eyes, you put food in the mouth. If you want to have healthy eyes, you stick the carrots in yours? So if we want to enjoy, we give enjoyment to our source. So Krishna says, Bhaktaram Yagatapasam, don't try to enjoy your results separately from being linked with the Supreme. It doesn't work. It's just like sticking carrots in your eyes. He says, I'm meant to be the enjoyer. I'm the whole of which you are a part. We are connected. If you sacrifice for the whole, then you will feel nourished. Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, and I'm running everything. I know, Krishna says, I'm God, I know what will be good and what will be bad. I designed the house, I know where the doors are, and I know where the walls are. And I can tell you, if you walk this way, it's a door. You walk this way, there's a wall, because I know I'm the designer. And Suvidam Sarvabhutanam, I'm your best friend. So if you follow me, Krishna says, I'm going to lead you in a way that will be good for you because I really know what's good for you. I mean, generally in the world, so many people tell us what's good for us, but they don't know and they don't ultimately care. The advertisers all tell us what's good for us, don't they? Buy this! If you buy this, you will look like this. Buy this laundry soap, and look what a happy family you will have. They don't know. Do they know whether or not buying that laundry soap is going to give you a happy family? Do they know that? They have no idea. You think they've done a study? Whether or not people who use that laundry soap have happier families? Well, you have a family that looks like the advertisement, or the car, you know, whatever, the laundry soap, the car, or the toothpaste. Do they really know that if you brush your teeth with that toothpaste, that all the women or all the men, depending on who you are going to follow you around? Have they done some study? Anyone who brushes their teeth, you know, everybody follows them around? They don't know. And sometimes the things they advertise will cause you problems, yes? So they have to recall their products or whatever. They're always changing what's good for you. Now we have a new study that what we told you was good for you last year is actually bad for you. I mean, when I was a kid, antibiotics and vaccines were the best thing in the universe. Seriously, when I was a kid, all diseases were going to be stopped by antibiotics and vaccines. It was just a few years down the road. I mean, by the time I was 20, nobody would ever get sick anymore, because really, anyone who's my age or older, you can remember this. Was it true? Did they know? They didn't know. Now they're saying, oh, don't take too many antibiotics. It's actually causing super infections. So the very thing they tell you is good, then it's bad. The thing they tell you is bad is good. So most people, they don't know. Even if they're your friend, they don't really know. And if they do know, are they your friend? Do they care? So Krishna, ultimately, no one can care about us more than God. Even our best friend in this world cannot care about us as much as God. So Krishna says, if you understand that you have to give happiness to your source, and that I know everything, and I'm your best friend, and you just work in connection with me, you become peaceful and happy. So how to do this? He says, well, one way to do this, you can go away from all of society if you want. Practice celibacy, control your breathing, meditate on the chakras, raise the life air to the top of the head, realize the self. And Arjuna said, I can't do that. I mean, look, I know I talked about walking away from the battlefield, and I know I talked about just giving up all my work, so I can understand why you're now instructing me how to do that, but I can't do that. So that's a very good teacher. If you say, this is what I want to do, this is what I want to do, and they know it's not good for you, they'll say, okay, that's what you want to do, this is what it means. You want that path? Okay, this is how you're going to have to follow it. So Krishna says, okay, Arjuna, you know, you want to walk away from the battle and just work on your enlightenment? There's a method for that. This is what you have to do. And Arjuna says, Chanchali Manakrishna, my mind is like the wind. How am I going to sit down all by myself in the middle of the woods, hardly breathing, hardly eating, walk away from my wife, and just sit there and meditate on the self? He said, I can't do it. Chanchali Manakrishna, how will I control my mind? And then he said, Krishna, what will happen if I fail? He said, if I fail, I will have walked away from all my material life, so I won't get anything, and then I'm going to try for enlightenment that way, I'm probably going to fail that way, so I won't get enlightenment either, I won't get material life or enlightenment. Ouch. And Krishna said, no. Anyone who even tries for enlightenment, swapa, even a little bit, they're never overcome by evil. He said, if you try and you fail, you'll take birth in a good family. He said, at least your next birth will be in a rich family, or a pious family, or a family of yogis. Anyway, Krishna says, Yogi nam abhisarvesham matpitenantaratma shadavam vajjateyamam samayuktatamamatam. The real yogi, the greatest yogi, is not just someone who leaves everything and sits down and meditates. The real yogi is one who's connected with the Supreme, one who has faith in the Supreme, one whose every actions are dedicated to the Supreme. And that is the end of the sixth chapter. So, do we have time for questions? Or just a few minutes, if anybody has any questions, comments.
Thank you for being in class. I was just curious if you could tell us why there were family members on both sides of the battle.
Oh gosh, that's a long story. You really have to read the Mahabharata, which is about this thick.
Summarize. No, that thick one is very summarized.
Oh, well, the summarized one is about this thick, yeah. How can I say it in like 2 minutes or less? Generally speaking, in those days, the persons who took over government were trained from birth. Not like what happened in Europe, where people became kings just because they were the oldest child of the king, whether they were qualified or not. But this is going back 5,000 years ago, when they were truly righteous kings on the earth. So people knew, just like today, they have reproductive science where you can just decide in the laboratory, they mix the sperm and the egg, and they can choose whether it's a boy or a girl, and they can look at the genes. And so they had sciences do mantras by which they could call certain kinds of children to take birth in the womb. So the royalty, both the men and the women of royalty, they would perform these subtle rituals, which really aren't really effective anymore. And they would be able to call a child who was very qualified to be the ruler. And then that child was trained from birth in order to be a proper government person. So generally, the line of government was hereditary, but it wasn't hereditary just in some blind way. So the person who would have been next to rule was named Bhishma. Bhishma's mother she was not an ordinary woman. She was a celestial being. And she had gone to another part of the universe. Bhishma's father, therefore, was without a wife. He decided he wanted to remarry. And the father of his to-be second wife said, "I don't want my daughter to marry you because you already have a son by your first wife, and that son will become the king instead of my daughter's son." And so this son, Bhishma, said, I vow I will never take the king. I'll never take the kingdom. Your daughter's son can become the king." And then the father said, "But your children will lay claim to the throne." And he said, "Then I will practice celibacy my whole life. I'll never marry, I'll never produce a child." Well, the problem was that Bhishma was qualified to be the king. That was the problem, and out of love for his father, he took these vows. So his father had two children by the second wife, but both of those children died very young. Well, then there was nobody to rule, and Bhishma had declared that he wouldn't rule. So he was actually running things, but without the title. Anyway, then there was nobody to rule. So there was an arrangement made to have that the widows of one of Bhishma's half-brothers would have a child by a great sage, Vyasadeva. So the king had two wives. There was polygamy in those days. And Vyasadeva had children with each of the two wives and also with one of their friends, one of their servants. So he produced three sons. So the one son was born blind. The oldest son was born blind. And again, by inheritance, he would have ruled. But as a blind king, the kings in those days used to go out and fight on the battlefield, not like the modern presidents and prime ministers who just sit in their office and tell the soldiers what to do and see the soldiers killed from a distance. So you couldn't have a blind person be the king. So then the second son became the king. He was a very good king. And he had five sons. So the line of inheritance would go through his sons. The blind brother, he had many children, and he thought, "I'm blind, but I should have become the king. If I hadn't been blind, I would have been the king. Therefore, the law of inheritance should go to my children, not to my brother's children." The brother who became the king and was a very good king died young. So all of a sudden you had, again, no king. You had nobody in charge. So you had the rightful king had died, his five sons were still very young. You had the older brother who's blind. So the older brother who's blind said, "Well, I'll be officially the king. I can't do everything. Bhishma will still do everything. But I'll take the title. Bhishma can't take the title of the king because he renounced the title. I'll take the title. Bhishma will still go and fight the battles and do all that stuff." And then he figured, as soon as my son grows up, he'll be the king. But everyone saw that his children were evil. They were so evil that as children, they tried to kill their cousins in order to cement their right to the throne. So they engaged in a number of murderous plots. So therefore the battle became between these cousins, between the five brothers of the good king and the sons of the blind man who took the throne unjustly. And that's, what did I do, 5 minutes? I mean, it's far more complex than that. Anybody else? Is that all right? Is that... And I'm trying to do this without overburdening you with 100 names. So I tried to really simplify it. So I don't have you swimming in complex names. Yes.
Yes. We talked about practicing celibacy and then controlling your breath.
Yes.
And trying to know more about yourself by doing the self meditation.
Yes.
Do we have any kind of practical insights or a kind of teachings from the spiritual masters? How is it we can meditate on yourself, or how is it to be a true yogi, or how is it to control your breath? More practical insights about these kinds.
Yes, there are parts of the Vedic literatures that describe this in detail, and there are certainly, of course, you have to go to a guru. There are gurus who can train you like this. At the present time on the earth, there's very, very few people who are qualified to attain enlightenment in that way. That particular path of enlightenment, it's a valid path to enlightenment. Although it's not the, even if you're qualified, it's not the preferred or most recommended path. Although it may particularly appeal to some people. But most people are not qualified, and if they try to go down that path, they'll most likely, first of all, fail, and second of all, they can even damage themselves going on that path. If they're not qualified. It's like if you gave a little child a chainsaw, they probably wouldn't use it very well and they might cut off their hand. So, you know, most of the people who teach that kind of meditation, they either really don't know what they're talking about, or in some cases they really do harm to people. There are some people on the planet today who are qualified to take up that path. I've met some of them. There are some. But even then, it's not the preferred path. It's not the path. The Gita is giving you many paths to enlightenment, but over and over and over again, Krishna is saying, this is the best one. This is the best one. It's the path of linking with the Supreme through loving devotion is the best one. But yes, there are certain instructions.
My point was, as this part of this movement, do we try to in fact do trying to teach?
We take up some of those principles. I mean, we certainly in this movement practice meditation, but not in that, as part of bhakti, rather than in that system entirely. So there's a system of karma yoga, we certainly do activities. There's a system of jnana yoga, we certainly study philosophy. The system of Dhyan Yoga, we certainly meditate. But we're not in a system of Karma Yoga or in a system of Dhyan Yoga or in a system of Dhyan Yoga. Although we certainly accept the principles of those systems are all contained within Bhakti Yoga. It has to be. Because they're all systems of enlightenment. They're all following essentially the same principles. If you'd like to see the relation between these paths, so I have a series of seminars on chapter 12, of Bhagavad Gita, which especially discusses these paths. And I believe that they're on YouTube where you can see, I have visuals with it. So if you look up Urmila Devi Dasi on YouTube, I believe you can find all three for chapter 12. And that will really explain the relationship between these different paths of Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Dhyan Yoga with Bhakti Yoga. Maybe we could take one moment.
Can you explain a bit more in detail about inaction?
Inaction. So Krishna says, one who sees inaction and action and action and inaction is wise. So a person may appear to be doing nothing, but if they're... Consciousness is on their own self-gratification. They're accruing karma just by their desires. and by the workings of their mind, they're going to implicate themselves again in action. They're not going to be able to stay in inaction for a very long time. Eventually, their desires will put them again into the cycle of action. Whereas someone who's doing action, but in an enlightened consciousness, in connection with the Supreme, is not accruing any reactions in this world. Neither pious nor impious. One's not getting any karmic reactions, although one is apparently acting. Because one is acting on a different platform. One is acting in true vision. One is seeing things as they are. And one is acting just for the satisfaction of the Supreme. So that's the platform of freedom. It may appear that they're, you know, going to work and driving a car and going to school and raising a family and doing all the kinds of ordinary things in this world, but they're not at all materialistic person. They're doing things for a different purpose. Something like, if you were a secret agent, if you ever wanted to be a secret agent. So if you're a secret agent. So it looks like you're a really good, you know, Russian citizen, but actually you're working for America. Something like that. So somebody's there in Russia and they see you and they see someone else and they think you're just like it, but you're not. You have a different purpose. So a materialistic person is thinking, how can I please myself? Or how can I please other people in order to please myself? How can I make my boss be happy with me so that I'll keep my job or I'll get a raise? How can I please my wife so she'll smile at me and give me what I want? How can I please my husband so he'll give me what I want? How can I please my kids so they'll just be quiet and leave me alone, let me get some peace? Whatever it is. You know, even when we're thinking of pleasing others, we're thinking of pleasing others ultimately because we're thinking, how can I get something for myself? And someone in transcendental consciousness, they're thinking, how can I please Krishna? So one person's sticking the food in their eyes, one person's sticking the food in their mouth. Both people are taking food and sticking it somewhere. So one person's getting nourishment, and one person's getting satisfaction, the other person's getting frustration. So when you're trying to please Krishna, it appears like action, but it's inaction. It's not creating any reactions. It's not entangling you in samsara. And even someone who's just sitting around apparently doing nothing, that's not necessarily inaction if they're full of material desires. Those desires will impel them. Is that all right? So now we have our feast. Our vegetarian feast offered to Krishna with love. And I do suggest you get the Bhagavad Gita and read it. Again, this was just a very brief summary. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.